I'm Deborah Becker. In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. The massive $789 billion economic stimulus plan that lawmakers agreed on after days of negotiating is on its way to final passage. It has more in tax breaks and less in direct aid to states than President Barack Obama originally wanted, but he compromised to try to bring some Republicans on board. Much of the money would flow to state governments, the unemployed, and many taxpayers. Joining us from Washington is Jonathan Weissman, who covers Congress for the Wall Street Journal. And Jonathan, can you describe what's in this version of the plan?
The big thing here right now is government spending, not tax cuts, and there is a ton of it. You're going to see a building boom from the ports to our waterways to our school districts to our roads and bridges and canals. There's just going to be a lot of cranes going up on the federal dime here.
And of course, a lot of money to states.
A lot of money to states. I mean, President did take a big hit from his initial number, but he got a lot back. At the last minute, they got a big plus up to spend more money in the school districts, over $50 billion to stave off cuts in education, stave off cuts in firefighters and corrections officers and prisons, and a big chunk of change to try to hold back cuts to Medicaid, because the insurance program for the poor, which is split between the states and the federal government, is really strained right now in the recession.
Well, let's go through the tax breaks just so folks know what may or may not happen here regarding tax breaks. The centerpiece is a worker tax credit. Can you just tell us who qualifies for that?
An individual would get $400 a year under this. A household would get $800 a year under this, and it would show up as lower withholding on your income taxes. So you'll just get a small boost each week or every other week, depending on how you're paid, in your paycheck for a couple of years.
And the unemployed also will get increases in weekly checks and longer benefits.
That's right. Unemployment is going to be extended by 20 weeks. A lot of people have been unemployed for quite some time, and their unemployment insurance benefits are running out. There's going to be a big 20-week extension of unemployment insurance, and in states with very high unemployment, and right now that's a lot of almost all of the states, you get an additional 13 weeks after that. So unemployment checks are not going to be running out anytime soon.
So you would have up to a year unemployment benefit depending on what state you live in.
That's right.
And what about business tax breaks? There was a bit of a compromise there, isn't that right?
There was this big proposal that actually President Obama had and the Senate had embraced, which would allow all companies to get a big credit for taxes paid going back as far as 5 years. So you could basically get a big check from the federal government. That was whittled down. It's only applying more to small businesses. There is a tax break for investment in plant and equipment for big businesses, and small businesses would get a big tax write-off of up to $250,000 for business expenditures. That would come right off the bottom line. So if you owe $300,000 in taxes, and you can claim $250,000 right off the bottom line, you would just own $50,000 in taxes.
And we should say that this is stimulus, which is very different from bailout, and I think there's been a lot of confusion between the two of them, at least from folks outside of the Beltway. And when we're talking about stimulus, we're also talking about job creation and the projections of what this stimulus bill might do in terms of job creation have changed a bit.
They have. They made one big concession to keep these three Republicans on board in the Senate. They included a $70 billion provision to stave off the growth of something called the alternative minimum tax. That is not going to be very stimulative at all. So there's $70 billion of the $789 billion won't do anything for jobs. That means that President Obama, who pledged to create 4 million jobs during his press conference on Monday night, last night came back and said, well, let's say 3.5 million. And, 500,000 jobs is 500,000 jobs, and they are now already adjusting downward their expectations for job creation.
And there's still Republican criticism, some Republicans criticizing this plan, and they're, one thing that's brought up repeatedly is the $30 million provision for wetlands restoration to protect wildlife, such as the salt marsh harvest mouse in San Francisco, which, of course, is House Speaker Pelosi's home district. How much of that kind of spending remains in this bill?
Well, look, there is a ton of spending. There's a ton of spending that's going to go through the EPA and the Department of Interior for this kind of wetlands restoration. There's a lot of money going to national parks. You know, to somebody, building new facilities or repairing facilities in Yosemite National Park would be considered pork. Somebody will say that, how dare you try to protect the salt marshes of San Francisco and this little mouse, but other people would say, well, why not?
But does it stimulate the economy, I think, is the argument.
Right now, the argument for stimulus is merely that Americans are so spooked with their economic circumstances, they are not spending. If you give them a tax cut, they probably won't spend it. The federal government has become the spender of last resort, and of course, if you're spending money to restore a wetland, somebody has to do it. It's not going to be, done by robots. Spending creates jobs at this point.
Well, we'll see. Jonathan Weissman, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, speaking with us from Washington, D.C. Thanks very much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
From the massive stimulus package to jumpstart the domestic economy, we turn now to U.S. spending in Iraq. Before the Iraq War began, U.S. officials estimated that the total cost of rebuilding the country after an invasion would be $2.4 billion. Today, the price tag is $125 billion and counting. Not only has the cost skyrocketed, but a recent government report says a lot of that money has been wasted. As the U.S. steps up its military presence in Afghanistan, what lessons can we take from the experience in Iraq? The report is called Hard Lessons, the Iraq Reconstruction Experience, and joining us now is Stuart Bowen, the Special Inspector General on Iraq Reconstruction. Mr. Bowen, let's start with the money. The original estimate, $2.4 billion, and now it's more than $125 billion. What happened?
First of all, the effort that was planned in 2003 massively expanded in the summer of 2003 as a result of a decision at the highest levels of the U.S. government to stay longer than expected. On March 10th of that year, the president approved a plan that would have the United States essentially out of the country by September. However, as we know, the invasion went very rapidly, and the removal of Saddam's regime occurred faster than I think that most expected. But looting ensued. There was some expectation there would be some disorder afterwards, but at the scale, I don't think so. And as a result, in July and August of 2003, an occupation evolved, and thus a great deal of investment had to be provided on the security front, much, much more than was ever anticipated.
Well, we'll talk about the security in just a minute. Let's just make sure that we clarify, in terms of $125 billion, when we talk about that total figure, how much is U.S. taxpayer money?
$50 billion in U.S. taxpayer money, about half of that to train the Iraqi security forces, and about half of that to build Iraqi capacity and repair their infrastructure.
And you also, in your report, boil this down to three main questions when we look at the U.S. reconstruction effort in Iraq. The first one you say is, did this reconstruction program meet the goals it set out for itself? And your answer is yes and no. Can you explain?
Yes. Eventually, after a significant expansion investment, the United States is meeting its goals on the security front. That is, the Iraqi army, the Iraqi police force is now chiefly responsible for internal security. However, on the infrastructure front, Iraq has not achieved or sustained the goals that were set back in 2003.
But when we talk about security overall, security is a bigger issue than just the Iraq security forces.
That's right. It's also about security for reconstruction workers at sites across the country. It's about the capacity of the United States to support the Iraqi government, to support the new provincial governments after the elections of last week, and to do so demands private security contractors, and a significant amount of money has been spent on those. We did an audit last quarter and found that over 300 contracts had been let in this area involving over $5 billion.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. Well, the first explanation is very difficult to get at this data because it's scattered across multiple agencies and there's no central clearinghouse. That was our first criticism. The second issue is that the level of oversight regarding these private security contractors has been inconsistent and needed to be improved. So we're going to do follow-up audits and reviews in this area over the course of 2009 to answer some of those remaining questions.
So in the part of your report when you're talking about not having the right structure to really sort of deal with this massive reconstruction effort, I believe that's an exact quote from former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Is that what you're talking about here? You didn't have a way to kind of manage all the separate groups and agencies that were involved here?
Exactly right, Deb. That's a symptom of the United States government not having a framework for carrying out contingency relief and reconstruction operations. Virtually every senior leader that I interviewed in the course of carrying out this project emphasized that point. Secretary Rice, Secretary Rumsfeld, Secretary Powell, they all pointed to weakness in this area. The United States is well-structured and has enormous capacities to address pre-conflict at the State Department, conflict at the Department of Defense, but for contingency operations, there's not an adequate framework, and that's really the chief purpose behind this report, to shed light on this weakness and to promote reform.
So if the chief purpose is to sort of look at how we have oversight and structure for a variety of agencies that will be involved in reconstruction, and you're looking at that and you're finding some of the weaknesses, were there also weaknesses in sort of the governmental structure of who's doing this job on our end in terms of Department of Defense folks and development folks as well?
Well, that's exactly right, and some of the hard lessons that we draw at the end of this report underscore that exact point. We recommend that the capacity of the United States government to provide development effort, to provide area expertise, to have a corps of contractors, to have a civilian reserve corps, all be expanded. And that's part and parcel, I think, of an organized framework, having someone in charge of planning and preparing for contingency operations should address each of these weaknesses.
Can you just give me a specific example so it's a little bit easier for us to visualize here exactly what's happening? What's an example of what you've come across that shows that we did not have that organized framework?
Well, I saw it virtually every one of my 21 visits to Iraq, the problems of insufficient integration between the Department of Defense, the Department of State, and U.S. Agency for International Development. But one area was the provincial reconstruction teams. We've done three audits. They've shown real improvement over the course of those audits. But the first one, I heard repeatedly from those working at the PRTs that they were trying to carry out projects with their money. Meanwhile, DOD money under the Command Emergency Response Program was carrying out projects out of their view, sometimes on the same sectors. And that weak coordination, that lack of integration, yielded duplication and waste.
We're speaking with Stuart Bowen about a recent report he issued on rebuilding and security in Iraq. Mr. Bowen is the Special Inspector General on Iraq Reconstruction. We'll be back with him after a quick break, here and now. Welcome back. We're talking with Stuart Bowen. He's the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, and he's recently issued a scathing report called Hard Lessons, the Iraq Reconstruction Experience, in which we learn that much of the $50 billion of U.S. taxpayer money spent rebuilding Iraq has been wasted. And Stuart, before the break, you were talking about how there was a lack of coordination between the Defense Department and Provincial Reconstruction Teams, or PRTs. Can you give me an example?
Well, when I was down in Babel province last November, I visited with the PRT team leader, and he raised real concerns about the fact that a courthouse was built in Hilla that they had not been consulted on, and that was only half finished, and that the provincial council didn't want because they didn't have the money to finish it. He said that the lack of coordination on that matter left him with a real vulnerability in his continuing engagement with Iraqi leaders in that province.
So who was building the courthouse?
That was being built by the Department of Defense under the Commander's Emergency Response Program.
Your report also, the second question I think we should say was that you said you set out to answer in your report was there a lot of waste and fraud? And again, we have a yes and no answer here.
Mm-hmm. Yes on waste. Absolutely. substantiated in 250 audits and inspections by my office over the last 5 years. The most egregious example is the Khan Bani Saad prison in Diyala province, about 40 minutes drive north of Baghdad. The Iraqis didn't want it, first of all. That's a lesson learned, to consult with the indigenous population to find out what they want. But more to the point, this project went on with continuous failures by the subcontractors until $40 million had been spent. The project was terminated at that point, tried to give it to the Iraqi Ministry of Justice, and they said no. So it sits in the desert, a monument, I think, to reconstruction failure, and the Iraqis in Diyala refer to it derisively as the whale. There are many projects that didn't get finished, and there's a practice called de-scoping, a term of art in contracting. It really means just taking what you initially intended on a contract, saying, well, we're only going to do 75% of it, amending the contract, and then declaring the contract complete, and then turning it over to the Iraqis. And this raises another critical area of waste, how we give projects that we finished or almost finished to the Iraqis. And that process is broken. As a result, hundreds and hundreds of projects have been unilaterally transferred to the Iraqi government, many of which they don't want.
And what about the fraud? How big of a problem is that?
It's an egregious problem, but relative to waste, it's not nearly as significant. Chapter 21 of our report gives a list of all those who've been convicted, 35 persons to date, majority military members, I'm sorry to say. But as I say in the report, the overwhelming majority, 99% of those who participated in the Iraq reconstruction enterprise, soldier, civilian, contractor, I think did so legally, properly. And we've caught a number of bad apples. We've got 19 indictments, 14 convictions, 5 people in prison, 9 more going to prison, and I expect 25 to 30 more indictments in the course of this year.
So that certainly sounds like a significant problem.
It's an egregious problem, but as I said, relative to the overall investment, it's a small component.
The third main question that you set out to answer in your report was, why did these reconstruction efforts so often fail to meet their mark? And in many cases, it was security.
That's exactly right. That's our first principle drawn in Chapter 27 of the report regarding reconstruction reform, and that is self-evident, but nevertheless a lesson. It is, don't carry out large reconstruction programs in an insecure environment. That is exactly what happened in 2005 and 2006 as the insurgency exploded across Iraq. And Ambassador Negroponte, when he arrived in mid-2004, carried out a series of reprogrammings into 2005 that moved money into the security sector, but it took a good while before that money began to make a difference in the capacity of the Iraqi forces to provide security.
And some members of your own team were affected by the lack of security in Iraq.
Yes, this has been oversight under fire, a very, very difficult mission that we've had. And on Easter Day of 2008, Paul Converse, one of my auditors, was killed when a rocket exploded next to his trailer in the green zone. And in 2007, I had 5 wounded from incoming fire.
Well, we're sorry to hear that.
Thank you.
When we look at what's happening in Iraq and you look at this continued lack of security and what's going on, and we're in Afghanistan as well here, and you say don't carry out a major reconstruction effort in an insecure environment, are we not learning any lessons from Iraq to apply them to Afghanistan, would you say?
Well, I met last week with the National Security Council representatives at the White House on exactly this point. And we spent over an hour discussing how the hard lessons of Iraq reconstruction can be applied to Afghanistan. And they were listening, and I think that they will apply them. In addition, I have a hearing on exactly this point in front of the House Armed Services Committee in a couple of weeks. I am confident that much of the challenge of Iraq will become instructive in Afghanistan. $32 billion has already been spent on relief and reconstruction in Afghanistan. The Special Inspector General there is looking at it, and his first 2 quarterly reports raise concerns similar to those we have raised.
So what would you say the most critical lesson you hope that the U.S. will take away from Iraq and apply in Afghanistan is?
I think the most critical lesson is the need for effective integration of civil-military operations. That means a framework needs to quickly be put in place in Afghanistan to ensure that the ambassador and the commanding general there coordinate effectively on carrying out targeted reconstruction that doesn't just build things to build things, but promotes a reconstruction policy that advances U.S. interests and builds Afghani capacity.
Well, Stuart Bowen, Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Deb. It's good to be with you.
President Barack Obama marked Abraham Lincoln's 200th birthday at the Capitol today. There, of course, have been several comparisons made between Obama and Lincoln. Both were lawyers from Illinois, both criticized as inexperienced, and both inherited major political challenges when they took office. But today, President Obama focused on the most striking connection between the two presidents.
But I can say that I feel a special gratitude to this singular figure who, in so many ways, made my own story possible, and in so many ways made America's story possible.
President Obama heads to Springfield, Illinois later today to give the keynote address at the Abraham Lincoln Association's annual banquet. By the way, on Monday, we speak with former Senator George McGovern about the legacy of Abraham Lincoln. Back after the news, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Bullying is more of a threat to children on the internet than sexual predators. That's the conclusion from a panel of researchers led by Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. A group of attorneys general commissioned the panel's study, and not all of them are happy. The AGs in North Carolina and Connecticut said that the study downplays the threats to children online. They went on to subpoena records that showed MySpace had found and banned 90,000 registered sex offenders from its site. So, where's the disconnect? Dana Boyd is co-director of the Harvard Task Force that looked into this issue. And Dana, 90,000 registered sex offenders? That sounds like a lot of potentially dangerous people on MySpace.
The question is, who are these registered sex offenders? Why are they there? And what are they doing? When you look at that number, you realize that there's 650,000 registered sex offenders in the United States. They're registered for a whole variety of different things, many of which are actually crimes against adults or between adults. So we also know that on social network sites, 35% of all American adults are there. So you'd actually expect to see a larger number, statistically speaking, of registered sex offenders than 90,000. You'd actually expect it to be double that. But the challenge is that, yes, it is a lot of actual registered sex offenders, but what are they doing? Are they actually causing harm to kids? And there's no good data that says that these guys there have any connection to kids or engaged in activities with kids online.
But couldn't it also be, though, that a lot of registered sex offenders are on the site, but they're using a different name?
It could be, but one of the challenges is when you're registered, you actually have to submit all of your identifying information, all of your email addresses you use, all of your logins, etc. The question is, are they lying online more than they're lying offline with where they go? Because they have restrictions about where they're allowed to actually go, when they're allowed to be near a school, etc.
So is there really, there must be threats for children online. Mm-hmm. What are the threats then?
There's direct threats, which is, you look at online harassment, so bullying. That's directly a threat for a huge number of kids online. And it's peer-to-peer. It's the kids in their school. Within the question of sexual predation and, sex acts between adults and children, the actual set of cases looks very different than our image of it. We've had this image of, this 50-year-old guy coming and abducting a 10-year-old or other such, type cases. When in fact, when you actually look at the data, it's actually a more disturbing picture. It is teenage boys and girls believing that they have the right to sort of engage in sexual acts with older adults, mostly men. And they meet up for sex, knowing that they're meeting up for sex with these adults, and they do so repeatedly. It's a model that, in legal terms looks like statutory rape, but is something that's really disturbing because these kids know that they're engaging in a sexual act. And that's when we start to get worried because they're clearly in trouble. They're clearly engaging in something they shouldn't be. These kids are typically at risk. They've got family problems. They've got drug and alcohol abuse issues. They've got challenges at school. And so it's this question of how do we deal with at-risk kids online, offline. The interesting thing about the internet is it makes this transparent in ways that were never transparent before. And so, yeah, a teacher at school might have known that a kid was in need of help, but you wouldn't necessarily know it, as part of the broader community. Now, as a community, as a society, we see these kids who are desperately seeking help, needing validation, and clearly in trouble. The question is, what is our responsibility as a society? Do we sit there and say, hey, I want to stop the technology because I don't want to see this? Or do we figure out a way to help those kids who are at risk?
But certainly there's been a lot of reporting and certainly television shows about dangers online and things that happen online, a lot of news stories about kids being preyed upon online by sexual predators. That is a problem.
We aren't seeing data like that. We are not seeing it at, you know, different research levels. We're not seeing it from the attorneys general. They're not giving us anything that looks like that. Now, might there be one or two that exist? Of course. You know, there are terrible things that happen online and offline. But when you have these rare cases and you extrapolate from them, you end up causing all sorts of other side effects. There's extreme value to kids having access to public space, whether it is physical public space or digital public space. And the more that we take that away from them because of fear, the more we actually make it difficult for them to grow up, for them to learn the social norms and how to interact with other people. But again, you go back to what the cases look like. There's two different styles of cases that you see brought forth by the law enforcement. One are cases that are often called entrapment, which is basically a police officer pretending to be a 10-year-old and seeking sex with an adult. And this is the To Catch a Predator story. The other set are the kids, and it's primarily teenagers, who end up meeting up with these guys for sex. But that's when you look at those cases and what the motivations and behaviors around it. When those kids know that they're meeting up for sex, it's an entirely different image than what the press puts out of the kids literally being preyed upon. Now, does it make it any less illegal or any less problematic? No, it is extremely problematic. But the ways to solve it, the ways to address it, are fundamentally different.
The attorneys general have said that they want new technology in place to try to help stop some of these registered sex offenders or predators who are online. What do you think should be done?
So our goal with the task force was to actually look at what is the problem and try to innovate around the problem. But you have to know what problem you're trying to solve. Rather than solving a myth, you have to solve the reality that's going on. I also think that technology won't actually solve this problem. I think one of the most important things we need online is social workers, people who do digital street outreach, people who are looking out for the kids online.
Digital street outreach.
Digital street outreach. We have a street outreach program in many of our major cities, but not online, which is another public for so many young people.
But those programs that are not online are obviously being cut because of the economy.
You got it.
So I don't see it happening online if we can't even have it on the street.
Well, and that's the question of, you know, who's actually doing it? Do you do it as a government service or do you do it as a community? I mean, there was once when parents around a community would watch out for the community. We're not seeing parents go online to actually look out for their kids' friends and the type of community that you would see in a traditional PTA. Adults are only engaging online in many ways to look out for their own kids and not to look out for the community.
So what advice do you give then to parents who are concerned about when their kids are on these social networking sites?
The main issue that parents have to look out for is what's going on in terms of bullying. This is the classic thing where parents didn't know when kids were getting picked on at school until there was a black eye. The same thing is happening online. Until it's escalated, parents often don't know.
Can I tell you that of my three kids, they don't want me online with
them.
I mean, obviously. So do you buy software to make sure you know what's going on? Do you get your own MySpace page and communicate with them? I mean, what do parents do to make sure that they're engaged in
you
all
know,
this?
You've got a different parenting philosophy that plays out here. My general view is that you work on building trust with your kids and having communication. And the question is, when as a parent you intervene? Do you listen in on your kids' phone calls? When things are bad, you might, but by and large, you don't. The same thing should go out online. When they're just having everyday conversations and there aren't major issues, you probably don't need to stalk them. But when there are issues where you're starting to get concerned, maybe you need to engage at a different level. You know, I talked to a lot of like coaches or youth ministers who were trusted by the kids and would be on there and be on the lookout for these kinds of things and engage parents when it was appropriate. The question within a particular community is, are there trusted adults? It may not be a parent. It may be, you know, an aunt or an uncle. It may be, you know, an older cousin. It may be, you know, a youth minister or somebody within the school framework. But finding that space for kids to have a trusted relationship with other adults is also really key to this.
A controversial military program in Afghanistan has social scientists working in combat zones to help the military better understand the local population. But the death last month of an American anthropologist is raising more questions about what's called the Human Terrain Program. Paula Lloyd was asking villagers in Afghanistan about the price of cooking fuel, which can be an indicator of whether insurgents have attacked supply lines. weapons. One man was carrying a jug of fuel, and after she spoke with him, he set it on fire and she was engulfed in flames. Minutes later, according to court documents, the leader of Lloyd's human terrain team shot and killed the attacker. Farah Stockman is covering this story for the Boston Globe. And Farah, first of all, tell us a little bit about Paula Lloyd. She was working as an anthropologist when she was attacked, but she was a soldier, right?
Yeah, she had a BA in anthropology from Wellesley College, but after graduating from Wellesley, she joined the Army. She stayed in it 4 years, and then she joined the reserves, and she was this extraordinary person in that she was a great soldier, and at the same time, she had a lot of skills as a social scientist, and she could really bridge these two worlds, I think, in a unique way that other people couldn't.
And who was the person who attacked her?
He was an Afghan man from Kandahar. It seems he was unknown in the village, and so I guess she'd been doing these interviews for a while, and many people in her program believe this was a premeditated attack, that this man traveled to that town to do this to her.
And he spoke to her in English?
I think there was a translator, but he thanked her in English, and he could speak a little English, and he walked up to her, from what I'm told, and he initiated the conversation. So it's not unlike some of the other attacks that the Taliban has had on Afghan women and girls. There have been attacks. Acid was thrown on schoolgirls going to school, and they attempted to set another U.S. soldier on fire. And so this is kind of a guerrilla tactic that's being used there.
So it does appear that this was some sort of a Taliban attack.
Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm. What about the other researcher who is now accused of killing the man who attacked Paula Lloyd?
Don Ayala was a bodyguard for years. He protected Afghan President Hamid Karzai. I also believe he had a military background before that. He was on this team as kind of a research assistant. I don't think he had formal training, but he knew a lot about Afghanistan. He has pleaded guilty to manslaughter in sort of a plea bargain, and I think he's going to be sentenced in May.
Are these teams, these human terrain teams, usually armed, and is it difficult for people to distinguish the anthropologists from the soldiers here?
I really think that's the crux of the issue. You know, the military recognizes that it needs more knowledge about the local population in order to be able to distinguish tribal politics and all kinds of issues that they're sort of in the dark about. But that has led to these kinds of social scientists being embedded into the military, and it seems many times they do wear fatigues and military gear, and they are armed. And I think it's part of why anthropologists are uncomfortable with the setup.
And what are anthropologists? What are some anthropologists saying about this and about what this means for this whole type of program?
Well, I think anthropologists are complaining about the use of the term. They don't want anthropology to be associated with the military endeavor. They have their own code of ethics, which says that, you know, subjects of studies should never feel coerced and that they should always be protected. And anthropologists feel uncomfortable with the methods of their trade being used to fight a war.
And finally, Paula Lloyd went to Wellesley College here in the Boston area, and in her will she asked that a fund be sent up to bring girls from Afghanistan to Wellesley College. Do you think that might happen anytime soon?
I think this is something that her mother and her friends are very dedicated to. Paula loved Afghanistan. She seemed to really love the people of Afghanistan, and I think that those who love her are trying to make this happen, and I'm not sure how they're going to do it, but I know that they're very dedicated to the idea of making this happen.
Farah Stockman, reporter for the Boston Globe, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Pitchers and catchers began reporting to spring training camp this week, and the shadow of steroids once again haunts Major League Baseball. Here to talk about the ongoing scandal and the rest of the week in sports is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hi there, Bill.
Hi, Deb.
Well, we began this week with news that New York Yankees infielder Alex Rodriguez admitted that he used banned substances, and yesterday former Baltimore Orioles All-Star shortstop Miguel Tejada pleaded guilty to lying to congressional investigators about about his knowledge of performance-enhancing drug use. And next month, of course, we have the perjury trial of Barry Bonds. Not a great way to start a season.
Well, not a great way for the Yankees to start the season. They're opening up a brand new ballpark, and they hoped that Alex Rodriguez would be the diamond in the middle of that diamond. as
Ouch.
You say, shadows hanging over that. And stories that aren't finished yet, and unhappily ongoing stories that will continue into the spring and summer and beyond, I imagine.
Right. Well, there are, 103 other names on the list of players who tested positive for using what are now considered banned substances. Why isn't baseball just releasing this list?
Well, the problem is that those names were never supposed to be released. The tests were conducted under the agreement that they were only to find out how widespread the use of these substances were in Major League Baseball. The people who tested positive were not supposed to be identified. The players' union agreed to the testing under that condition that the names would not be released. So just because one leaked, does that mean the other 103 should be leaked? I have trouble with that logic. I don't think so.
Yeah, but it's certainly slippery.
Very slippery.
What about Tejada's conviction? What does that mean? Of course, now we have Roger Clemens, a former All-Star pitcher. He's under investigation for perjury by the same prosecutors who struck the plea deal with Tejada. What's going on, Bill?
Well, the whole Clemens business has been so erratic and strange, charges and countercharges. Clemens has denied everything despite what some people consider pretty convincing physical evidence coming from his former trainer. Clemens and his lawyers have to be looking at this, and it would seem to me have to be thinking in terms of, you know, how do we best cut our losses? I would imagine that we'd learn something more about that fairly soon.
Right. Let's move on to the NBA. All-Stars play on Sunday. What do you think we're going to see here, Bill?
I think we'll see LeBron James and Kobe Bryant score 78 points and 67 points, respectively, because there is a law in NBA All-Star games against defense. And so I think the NBA long ago decided that the best way to sell its product was to glamorize individual players, and they've got two of the best individuals, one playing for the East, one playing for the West, and so it ought to be a great spectacle.
So good for the game.
Sure, why not? It's a show. I mean, nobody believes that the All-Star game is a true competitive event, you know, where people really play basketball the way they play on all the other nights. They're playing run and gun. They're scoring a lot of points. Get out of my way. I can dunk. That's the kind of theory of the game.
And Bill, Brett Favre announces again that he's retiring. What's happening?
I believe him this time because he's not a boxer. And boxers retire zillions of times. Football players once, twice. That's probably about what they do.
All right. Well, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's weekly sports show, Only a Game. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Deb.
Well, you could put our next story in the Sometimes Dreams Do Come True category. In the early 1970s, Jim Meradian of Winchester, Massachusetts, was a young man who, like many young men, wanted to be a rock star. His idol was Chris Squire, the bass player from the British progressive rock band Yes. Jim spent his days making hand-woven rugs for his family business. At night, he played bass in his band. And one day, rugs and rock got rolled up together. Here's his story.
I had the unbelievable good fortune. The very first guitar I built at all ended up going to my hero, my musical mentor, Chris Squire. I had talked myself into meeting Yes. I used the old family skills that I learned in the rug business to make a rug for them of their logo. They, of their own volition, came down and around and stood around the rug and go, "What the heck is this?" They were so thrilled with this rug. They wanted to know, can we get other ones? What colors do they come in? My heart was pounding being in the same room with my musical heroes. And they, on the other hand, were thrilled with this rug. So Chris said, "Come back after the show, let's talk some more." He gave me a secret password. And that allowed me into this private dinner that was happening after their show. And we just got to talking about a whole wide array of subjects, from astronomy to all the music influences. And it started to become a joke that I was Chris's little brother with the other guys. Oh, here's Chris with his little brother. So So I made a couple more rugs for the band. They invited me to go help them build the stage for what was to be the Relayer tour. So I got to spend 6 days and nights with them and got to know these guys who, again, are still my musical heroes, but on a very casual and friendly and normal basis. When a subsequent tour came through Boston, I had a picture in my pocket, a drawing of this bass guitar design. And so during the course of dinner, I showed it to Chris, expecting him to go, yeah, that's cute, stick with the rugs. But he loved it. He said, that is great. And so he goes, well, why don't you make one of those? Paint it green. You never see green instruments. And put my initials on it. What he didn't know at that time was I had never done more in terms of building a musical instrument than change strings on my own basses, or, ooh, I think I'll put new knobs on it. That'll be fun to do. Those sorts of things. Fiddling around with a pencil, I laid my Fender Jazz Bass on the floor and traced its periphery, and then just stood back and looked at it and messed around with a couple things and found that if I went inside the outside peripheral shape of the guitar, there were curves that I could continue on and through. And with a little bit more noodling around, finessing, I started to see a design that would be visually striking to the observer, but absolutely comfortable and familiar to the person playing. I realize now at 58, when I did this when I was about 28, that I should have been petrified. You know, my knees should have been knocking when I finally gave it to him. But at the time, I was just like too young and naive to understand what an incredibly lucky, for lack of a better term, scenario I found myself in. Giving an instrument that I built from scratch. I mean, it wasn't like I bought a neck out of the catalog. I went and picked out the wood from a cabinet builder. And then this neck is reinforced with something that I came up with. I mean, imagine, guys who do what I do, the thing that they dream about being able to do one day is to get an instrument that they built into the hands of somebody that they admire. It stood the test of time. It's still straight enough and solid enough that he's playing it every night still. And the other thing is he and all the other members of Yes have been so gracious and supportive that myself being kind of shy and insecure, to have them embrace me and bring me into the Yes family and joke around with me and call me knucklehead and all that when I was a kid. And now I'm the guy that one in, I don't know if it's, I think it's one in a million, that has had his life end up to be exactly all that he could have ever hoped for.
Jim Maradian owns Maradian Guitar Repair Shop in Winchester, Massachusetts. His story came to us from Here and Now's Tim Skog. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Robin Young will be back tomorrow. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.